You'll be turning to Acts chapter 28. Acts chapter 28. Can you believe it? We're about to finish this up. How long have we been in the book of Acts? Has it been 2 years? I believe so.
I think we're 82.
Less than 82. Less than 82. So that's definitely more than 1 year. Probably about 2 years, year and a half, somewhere in there. But we're quickly approaching the end of the book of Acts, and then after that we're going to go to the book of Daniel. Pardon me. We're going to go to the book of Daniel after we finish Acts here in our adult Sunday school class. Paul, as you know, was taken as a prisoner, sent from Caesarea to Rome by way of a merchant ship traveling with other prisoners. And Julius, the commander of 100, he's a centurion, so he had 100 soldiers with him. Also Aristarchus of Thessalonica, and Luke was also with him because he uses the terminology us and we. I put up the map up there so you can see when they sailed from Caesarea, they sailed hugging the coastline all the way around there to Lycia, Myra of Lycia, and then they switched merchant ships there. But the problem was this journey had gone slowly, taking many days and with much difficulty. They anticipated this trip to go much quicker, but the problem was that they set sail late in the year, and so the winds were unfavorable for sailing, and because of the delay, being out in the open ocean now would soon become dangerous. When they ported at Fair Havens down on the bottom side of Crete down there, Paul recommended that they stay put right there for the winter. He feared that if they continued, they would lose their cargo, the ship, and possibly even some lives. But they wouldn't listen, and they determined to sail around to the port of Phoenix and winter there. That's over on the northwest side of the Isle of Crete there. So when it looked favorable to them to set out, they set sail. But a terrible storm came up out of nowhere and pushed them out into the open sea. To try to keep from taking on too much water, they started to throw things overboard. In other words, cargo, money, went overboard, which is what Paul had warned them about. This storm was so bad, they all began to think that they were going to die, that the ship was just going to break apart, and that they were all going to drown. But Paul tells them that an angel of the Lord had visited him and told him that they would all live, but the ship would be lost. It seems that they didn't put much stock in what Paul had to say at first. But on the 14th night, they came near land and dropped anchor to wait for the morning. Four anchors, by the way, at the back of the ship to hold the ship in place. Paul tells them that they need to eat because they're going to need their strength for what lies ahead. They see a place the next day where they think they can get the ship up onto shallow water, as close to the shore as possible, and then swim safely from there a short distance. However, as they start to make for the land, the ship runs aground further out from the shore than they anticipated, and the storm is still raging, so the waves begin breaking the ship apart in this shallow water. The Roman soldiers want to kill all the prisoners to make sure that nobody escapes, but Julius forbids them to do so. Julius the commander, the centurion. And the reason is, we find in Scripture that Luke says, is because that he had become fond of Paul and he didn't want Paul to be killed. So he tells everybody that's on the ship just to make for sure the best that they can. And they all arrive safely on shore, all 276 people that were on this sailing vessel. That's exactly what God had promised would happen, that they would all live, but the ship would be lost. And so it was. It happened that way. Paul had delivered them that message, and it came true, just as God said. And that's where we pick up the story today in Acts chapter 28. Acts chapter 28 and verse 1. Now when they had escaped, that is, escaped from the ship, they then found out that the island that they were on was called Malta. Now that's what it's called today. So the New King James uses the modern name for the island, Malta. If you're looking in the King James, I believe it says Mileta. Now if you were to look at a map of Malta today, there is a bay there called St. Paul's Bay. It's on the northeast end of the island. And there's even a place offshore from that called St. Paul's Shoal. And traditionally, this is where they believe that the ship ran aground and then everyone swam to safety from there. However, in 1971, four first century Roman anchors were found in St. Thomas Bay, which is on the southern end of the island. And there is a long point of land that sticks out from there just under the water. So when you look at it from a satellite view, you can actually see it stretching way out from the land. And so many now believe that that is where the ship ran aground, on that point of land. And you say, well, wouldn't they have known? Wouldn't, you know, I mean, people sailed around that island all the time. Wouldn't they have known that this long point sticks out there, or if it's at St. Paul's Bay, that shoal was there? Well, yes, but you have to remember, these sailors at this time had no idea where they were. Now, had they known where they were, they would have known what to look for. But they didn't know where they were, so they didn't know what to look for. If you want my personal opinion, by the way, if it's St. Paul's Bay or St. Thomas Bay, I tend to think it probably was St. Thomas Bay. Finding those four anchors there out from the shore, first century Roman anchors, is kind of what settles it in my mind, along with that long point sticking out just under the surface. Because, you know, when they got ready to go and let the ship go up and run aground, they wouldn't have pulled the anchors in. They would have just cut the ropes, and because they didn't want to have more weight. So don't pull the anchors in. Again, they're trying to get rid of all the weight that they can, so they would cut the ropes and left the anchors out in the water. So,
Gee, do you mean that
archaeology can sometimes support the events of the Bible? Absolutely, yeah. It's interesting to me, though, that those weren't discovered until 1971. I mean, that's, you know, when this ship ran aground, way back, you know, in the first century AD, and now here we are with the discovery in 1971. They had been tossed about at sea for 14 days, driven across the open sea, approximately 460 miles. Their journey was not in a straight line. We saw last week that they were pushed up and down as they went across the sea. So again, they had no idea where they were when they first got there, but as they get to land, they do find out that it is the island called Mileta at the time, or modern-day Malta. Verse 2. And the natives showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and made us all welcome because of the rain that was falling and because of the cold. The natives, it says in the New King James Version. What does it say in the King James? The barbarians. The barbarous people. The barbarians. What do you think of when you hear that kind of phrase? Yeah, like people with loincloths and spears and, you know, that kind of thing. So it's kind of an unfortunate translation. The reason it's called barbarous people or barbarians is because of the times. In the times in which it was written, it doesn't mean that they were barbarians in the way that we would think of it today, a warmongering people. At the time, anyone who didn't speak Greek or Latin, one of the two major languages, if they didn't speak Greek or Latin, then they were considered barbarians, barbarous people. And so that's why it's translated that way. These natives were very kind to them, though. They showed that they were not barbaric in nature. They kindled a fire for them. In my mind, I think that's a huge understatement. A fire. How many people do we have? 276, plus now some natives. There's, you know, about 300 people here on the shore. I think they kindled more like a bonfire for the people, or, you know, multiple fires, maybe. But you got a lot of people here, so keep that in mind. Imagine how good that felt. They've been at sea for 14 days, tossed in this storm. Can't have a fire there. Why not? Burn the ship up. So then they, you know, get out in the wet cold rain, having to swim to shore, so I'm sure a fire felt very nice at that time. Verse 3. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. A poisonous snake bit Paul on the hand. So Paul had gone to gather some sticks for the fire, and in the process, apparently, there was a snake in there, and it bit him on the hand. Have you ever done anything like that? Yes? Oh, a copperhead. Came out of what? Oh, you set it on fire. Yeah, we've had that happen. Having a burn pile, and then when the conditions were right, burn it, and then one of our burn piles, there were like 6 copperheads that came out, and everybody went scrambling on top of vehicles. It was one of those, you know, we were younger and you invite friends over a big bonfire, and then all these snakes come running out. When we lived out in the country, one time it was rain, I couldn't mow, and when I did mow, it was more like baling hay, and there were these big clumps of grass. And so I went around pulled with my little lawn tractor, pulling the trailer behind me, gathering up these big clumps of grass, and I gathered one up, and I'm walking toward the trailer, and a head pops out. 1 second later, I was 50 feet away, I'm telling you, if it even took that long. But you know, then it hit me, that wasn't a poisonous snake, the head was green. It was a grass snake, the biggest grass snake I've ever seen. It was about 2 foot long, but it had gotten coiled up in there. So, snake is a snake to you? You're one of those people? So is my wife. She's one of those people. Same with spiders. No, she doesn't care. I check to make sure if they're friendly. I don't kill the good ones. But anyway, yeah. Whew, you can imagine. But anyway, this one, it not only pops out, but what? It bites Paul on the hand. But he just shakes it off into the fire. But wait on. Paul is gathering sticks. Where would you be? Yeah, at the fire. I mean, if I'm one of these people who's gone through this ordeal, I'm wet, I'm cold, I would want to be near the fire. Paul is out gathering sticks for the fire. Man, what? Paul had the heart of a servant. I mean, to the ultimate here. Sure, he's in discomfort and everything, just like everyone else, but he's still being a servant. What a challenge for us and our attitude. You know, Paul knew that God had brought everything to pass, as it did come to pass, and God had entrusted Paul with this message, but he didn't puff up Paul's pride any. Paul still remained humble. If we're not intentional about it, then our flesh will certainly take advantage of situations to puff itself up. We must be intentional about being humble in our mind. Being careful against our flesh that is quick to pop up and take credit and, you know, make us the big shot. And that feels good, doesn't it? Again, the problem is sometimes we let the flesh take advantage of that and run away with us, and then our testimony is shot. An opportunity that we had to testify for the Lord. But we have to make sure to guard against this kind of attitude and just be humble. Verse 4. Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, Paul said in Romans chapter 12. Is that where that's at? Verse 4. So when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, "No doubt this man is a murderer, whom, though he has escaped the sea, yet justice will not allow him to live." The snake here, this venomous beast, is actually, I think that's the way the King James renders it. No? What does it say?
Viper.
In verse 4, it still says viper. Venomous beast. Yeah. It did say viper there in verse 3, right? That a viper came up and bit him on the hand. Here it just says snake, though, venomous beast. So the question arises, was it just any old poisonous snake? What kind of poisonous snake was it? Was it a viper? The interesting thing about the island of Malta is that there are no vipers present. And there's no evidence that there ever was a poisonous viper that was indigenous to Malta. So some think that the island was, you see up there at the top, it says Adriatic Sea. Some think that the island that they were pushed to is actually further up there. There's an island up there that does have vipers that are native to that island there. So what are we to do with this? Was it or was it not a viper? Now there is a poisonous snake on the island of Malta. It's referred to as the cat snake, but it's not a viper. So what do we do? What do we do with this?
Believe the Bible.
Is the Bible wrong? Did the translators mess it up? Is it the wrong island? Was it not this Mileta that's now the island of Malta? Was it a different Mileta? Because the one up there also, there's evidence that it was also called Mileta. What do you think?
Maybe it was
Satan in the form of a snake, again, as from Genesis. So, if there's no viper that is indigenous to the island of Malta, does it mean that it's impossible for a viper to be on the island of Malta? No. How could it possibly get there, though, if it's not indigenous? By ship. I mean, we just read, you know, that there's shipping that took place. Snakes could have gotten on a ship and then when it's at port, gotten off of the ship. Could very well have been in another ship that was shipwrecked at one time and then got to the island and then it found refuge in a bundle of sticks and Paul found it. I mean, we have this kind of situation today where things that are not indigenous to a certain area can appear somewhere else because it hitches a ride on a ship. So as Brother Ken said, I'm going to take what the Bible says. And if the Bible says it was a viper, and that's the Greek word that's used there to describe the viper, then it's not impossible for it to be a viper that got him. Anyway, you know, it's one of those things where people say, look, the Bible's wrong. It says a viper, but there's no vipers there. Doesn't mean there can't be a viper there. Anyhow, moving on. Verses 5 and 6. But he shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. However, they were expecting that he would swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But after they had looked for a long time and saw no harm come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. Again, Paul just shook off the snake into the fire as if it was nothing. They continued watching him, expecting him to, you know, to fall down dead at any moment. But Paul didn't die. Paul didn't suffer any ill effects from this bite at all. So they changed their mind and instead, you know, I mean, a few moments ago, Paul was a murderer who had now, his comeuppance had come. But now, no, he must be a god. Boy, that is the nature of our fickle, superstitious nature, isn't it? As humans, we see the reverse kind of things in Acts chapter 14 at Lystra. Do you remember that? Paul and Barnabas went into Lystra and they healed a lame man and they supposed that Paul and Barnabas were the gods come down to them. And so they start to celebrate and they're bringing out animals to make sacrifice to them. At first, Paul doesn't understand what's going on. They were speaking in their own native tongue. But he figures out what's going on and then he stops them from doing it. You remember what he told them? He says, Barnabas and I are what? We're not gods. What are we? Ordinary men. Just like you. We're ordinary men with the same passions as you have. Then some unbelieving Jews came to town. They stirred up some trouble. And what do? The people of Lystra. I mean, they thought Paul was a god, but then, you know, they changed their mind very quickly in the opposite direction. They decide that he is worthy of death. And so they stone him. Drag him outside of the city and leave him for dead. Verse 7. In that region, there was an estate of the leading citizen of the island, the chief, whose name was Publius, who received us and entertained us courteously for 3 days. And it happened that the father of Publius lay sick of a fever and dysentery. Paul went into him and prayed, and he laid his hands on him and healed him. So when this was done, the rest of those on the island who had diseases also came and were healed. They also honored us in many ways, and when we departed, they provided such things as were necessary. So in verse 7, we find that Publius, the chief man of the area, shows hospitality to us, Luke says, for 3 days. How big was this man's house? 276 people, and he invited them all into his house. You think? No. I don't think so. I think they did show hospitality probably to all of the people, but who is the us that came into Publius's home? Certainly it's not all 276 that were on board the ship. But Luke is one of them. But who do you think else with Luke? Luke? Paul? Probably Aristarchus. I think it's probably the us. The centurion? Maybe the captain of the ship and the owner of the ship. I mean, he is the chief. He probably does have a fairly nice dwelling place and could lodge 5 people and treat them hospitably. The others, though, probably not. Julius probably stayed with his soldiers outside or wherever they were, however they camped about. So Paul, Luke, Aristarchus for sure, maybe the captain and the ownership. Publius's father was ill, and so Paul does what?
Praise.
There you go. I was looking for somebody to shout out, heals him. He did eventually get there. But the first thing Paul does is pray. Again, man, what a lesson for us. We want to be people of action, right? Especially us men. We're bad about this. If something goes wrong, we want to fix it. People of action. But, you know, the first thing we need to do is pray. Too often, we skip that step. We need to stop and pray. And that's the first thing that Paul does. Prays. And he prays for this man, and then he heals him. Then when word gets out about that, sick people come from all around, and what happened to them? Well, you know, if they had enough faith, that's not what it says, people. That's what certain denominations would have you believe today, that purport to have the power of healing. You know, faith healers in their congregations. That's not how it works. Their faith is not what healed them. It was the healer that healed them. The Apostle Paul had the ability to heal them, all of them, regardless of their faith. But I'm sure it did help their faith along when the Apostle Paul healed them and they saw Paul healing. But those miracles, those have passed. We'll come back to that in a moment. Paul heals them, though. A couple of years after this, Paul writes a letter to Timothy. I want you to turn to 1 Timothy chapter 5. Paul writes a letter to Timothy, giving him some instruction and some encouragement. Timothy was believed to be pastoring the church at Ephesus at this time, I believe, if I remember my history correctly. And then Paul writes to him, 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 23. He says, "No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities." Timothy was ill. Why not just heal him? Why does Paul prescribe wine for him?
His ability to heal.
Yeah, he couldn't heal him. Not at this time, because the thing is, these were sign gifts for the nation of Israel, and those gifts were passing away here toward the end of the book of Acts, and by the close of the book of Acts, they're gone. Paul couldn't heal him anymore. In fact, look at 2 Timothy chapter 4. The Apostle Paul goes to Rome and he's imprisoned. I believe he was released for a short time before being arrested again and being brought back to Rome and then executed. But during that short time of release, Paul did some traveling around. But then he wrote back to Timothy, the last letter we believe he wrote before he was executed. So in his second imprisonment, he wrote back to Timothy, 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 20. Paul says, Erastus stayed in Corinth, but Trophimus I have left in Miletus. What? Sick. Who left him there? The writer here says, I left him there. Who's the writer? Paul. Paul left him sick. Why not just heal him? Why could Paul heal all of these people on this island of Malta, Miletus, who were sick? But didn't heal him here. Again, things changed, you see. God's program was not the same. It's not the same today as it was then. In fact, it changed very quickly from this point in Acts chapter 28, where those sign gifts were set aside. These sign gifts were for the Jews. They were to confirm, first of all, that Paul indeed was an apostle of Jesus Christ. He was one sent by Jesus Christ. Because remember, the 12, when they were sent out, they had the ability to do these sign gifts. And so Paul was no less of an apostle. So he had that ability as well. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Paul, speaking of himself among them there in Corinth, which again, second missionary journey and third missionary journey before Acts 28, Paul says, truly the signs of an apostle were accomplished among you with all perseverance and signs and wonders and mighty deeds. Paul was able to perform signs among them. And what were those signs for?
The Jews.
Proof, yeah, that he was an apostle. The signs of an apostle, he says, were performed. But also, those signs were for the Jews to prove that Jesus Christ really was their Messiah who could fulfill all the Old Testament promises that were made to them. We looked at this extensively when we first came into the book of Acts. The prophecies about the lame being able to walk and the deaf being able to hear and the dumb being able to speak and things of that nature. Jesus Christ proved that he had the power to fulfill those promises. We're almost at the end of the book of Acts here. The rejection of the Jews to accept Jesus Christ as their Messiah is evident by this point. However, God is still reaching out to the Jews, even at this late stage of the record here. These are Jews on this island. But Paul performs the sign miracles among them, specifically here, the miracle of being able to handle a snake, and even if it bites him, doesn't harm him at all. And he's able to heal other people. He healed them. Why, though? What's that, Dorman? Yeah, still, it's evidence that he is an apostle that represents the resurrected Jesus Christ. Gives him the ability, gives them an opening to them to share the gospel with them. Why else do you think Paul did it? The right thing to do, yeah. Because Paul had the ability to do it. Paul had compassion on them. Remember, he had a servant's heart. I mean, if you see these hurting people in front of you and you have the ability to do something about it, wouldn't you? Shouldn't you? So Paul could. He had compassion. He healed them because he could. They had a need, and he was able to help them. And it's an opportunity then, an opening to share Christ with them. And not just with the people on the island, but who else is here with him? Other prisoners and the centurion, Julius, and
his
100 men that are with him. And where are they going?
Rome.
To Rome, together. And remember, this is a special band of soldiers. Look back up at chapter 27. Chapter 27 and verse 1. It says, and when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some of the prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. This is a special regiment, you see, that serves the Caesar in a special way. And so this is a special band of soldiers. And they're going to Rome, and guess what they're going to talk about when they get there? What happened to them, and how there was this man named Paul who told them they were all going to survive this thing, every one of them, and they did, just as Paul said. And then when we got to that island, I mean, if you think that was something, guess what happened when we got there? He was bitten by a viper and it didn't do anything to him. And then he healed all of these other people. So now picture kind of comes together, why God would allow this to happen. Even though it's at this late stage, even though the rejection of the Jews is evident, you know, there's more to it than that. Back to our passage, Acts chapter 28 and verse 10. It says, they also honored us in many ways, and when we departed, they provided such things as were necessary. They're going to catch another merchant ship now, we'll find out in verse 11, that's headed toward Rome. And what do they have to take with them as they go? Nothing. When they got off of the ship and came up on the shore safe and sound, they only had with them the clothes on their backs, pretty much. They had already tossed over all the cargo. They had already tossed over what was left of the food. And then the ship was broken apart, so you know, they've got nothing. So what do they need then to get to Rome? Everything. You know, some change of clothes would be nice. At least just one. Food. Got to have food for the trip. So the people of the island, they supply all of this because of what Paul had done for them. See how it ties in once more? Because Paul did these things, now the people of the island are able to supply them with the things that they need to continue on to Rome. And how much now does it cost Julius? Nothing. Because the islanders do this out of gratitude. So they're able to continue in verse 11. After 3 months, we sailed in an Alexandrian ship whose figurehead was the twin brothers which had wintered at the island. So there was another Alexandrian ship here that had wintered at this island. So they catch this ship now. They let 3 months pass. Then they catch this ship, headed also to Rome. And this ship sails under the sign of two Roman Greek gods of mythology. These Greek gods were said to be, first of all, the founders of Rome. And then they are also said to be protectors of sailors. Don't want to get too deep into that, but Paul just gives us a bit of a description there. Verse 12, and landing at Syracuse, we stayed there for 3 days. So we can go back to our map now. They sail from Malta and they go to Syracuse. And this is why I believe the record here is correct about where they were, what island they were at, because their next stop is Syracuse. If they were up there in the Adriatic Sea proper, up in there somewhere to an island, why would you then come all the way back down to Syracuse? To port. That doesn't make any sense. But they're headed toward Rome, so they port at Syracuse there. They stay there for 3 days. And verse 12, from there we circled round and reached Rhegium. And after 1 day, the south wind blew, and the next day we came to Puteoli. We circled round. I like the way it says it in the King James better. It says, we fetched a compass. We fetched a compass. It means, though, that they circled round to come to the toe of the boot there. And then the south wind blew, which is what they needed. And so they continued on. In verse 14, when they stopped at Puteoli. How do you like that? Puteoli. When they stopped at Puteoli, they found brethren who were there and invited us to stay with them 7 days. and then we went toward Rome. So now all 276 people come to another no. They invited us to come with them. Who's the us? I'm sure this time it's only three. Luke and Paul and Aristarchus, who they take in. But how refreshing it must have been. They come to port and they find people that they knew here at this port. You know that's got to be encouraging. And then they stayed there 7 days. Why do they stay there 7 days at this port? Judd? We're not told. Sometimes you just get a little bit under my skin, Brother Judd. I want to know. I want to know why they chose to stay here 7 days. But, you know, they're on the ship. They're at the whim of the ship. So, maybe it takes that time. Maybe they were waiting for something and it was just late. You know, come on, when's he getting here? He said he was going to be here yesterday. I don't know. I guess his cell battery died or something. But, you know, I don't know. We're not told. But again, man, what an encouragement to come and be among fellow believers. It's the same thing here, isn't it? I mean, we come here and we try to act like we got it all together. Our life is great. We come in here, we don't want to share our problems with everybody, right? Too often that's the attitude we have. But even when we have that attitude, which is the wrong attitude, I mean, I know life is difficult. There are some very difficult, painful things that happen to us in this earthly journey. But when you walk through those doors and you come in here, doesn't it just feel different? I mean, doesn't it just feel like, even if just for a couple of hours, the weight is lifted when you have fellowship among fellow brothers and sisters in Christ? So you can imagine here how it felt for Paul and Luke and Aristarchus as they come and they find fellow believers, people that they knew here, how greatly encouraged that they were. Verse 15, and from there, when the brethren heard about us, they came to meet us as far as Apolliforum and three inns. And when Paul saw them, he thanked God and took courage. They're making stops at these ports along the way, see? Apolliforum from Puteoli, Apolliforum, three taverns, three inns, and then before they get up to port at Rome. And at each of those stops, they heard Paul was coming, and so there were people there, fellow believers, that met them at those ports. How did word get there faster than Paul and all of those that were with him could get there? Well, they were there in Puteoli for how long? 7 days. So that gave an advanced start for whoever was traveling up the coastline there, headed toward Rome, to spread word that Paul was coming. So that's probably the biggest part of it, how word got quicker by land than by sea, or maybe even by sea, from some other ships that were traveling up that way that headed out before the ship that Paul was on headed out. But Paul saw fellow believers at each port. It says he thanked God for them, and what? He took courage. He was encouraged even more. Verse 16. Now when we came to Rome, the centurion delivered the prisoners to the captain of the guard, but Paul was permitted to dwell by himself with the soldier who guarded him. When Paul is turned over as a prisoner here with all the other prisoners, Paul again is given special treatment. Why do you think that is? Oh, we don't have enough time left, do we? I mean, we'd have to go back and see this whole journey, all the way back to when Paul was arrested in Jerusalem. And that Paul was guilty of nothing, really. And in fact, the only reason he's here is because he's appealed his case to Rome. And then all the things that happened along the way. So when Julius turns Paul over to the captain of the guard, of course he's going to have some nice things to say about Paul. And that Paul then gets treated differently. Paul's a Roman citizen, hasn't committed any crime. saved lives, healed people, didn't try to run away, etc., etc., etc. Paul's able then to stay in a house. Skip down to verse 30. Hold your place, but turn to verse 30. Then Paul dwelt 2 whole years in his own rented house and received all who came to him, preaching the kingdom of God and teaching the things which concern the Lord Jesus Christ with all confidence, no one forbidding him. He stays in a house, receiving guests. People can come and go as they wish. He's able to continue his ministry safely under Roman guard. How awesome it is the way God worked everything out. Paul, later writing to the church at Philippi, which we have in our Bible as the letter of Philippians, they were concerned about Paul being in prison. But Paul said, I don't want you to be concerned at all. He said, I want you to know that the things that have happened to me actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel. It was actually a great thing what happened. That's Philippians chapter 1, verses 12 through 14. The gospel propelled forward. Paul was a prisoner, yeah, but a prisoner of a special kind. He was living in a house, a rented house, that he was able to pay for and stay in. And a guard would come and be chained to him throughout the day and the night. And while that guard was here, what do you think they heard about? Jesus Christ. No doubt. Each and every one of them. Let's finish up for this morning. We're going to stop with verse 20. Verses 17 through 20. And it came to pass after 3 days that Paul called the leaders of the Jews together. So when they had come together, he said to them, Men and brethren, though I have done nothing against our people or the customs of our fathers, yet I was delivered as a prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans, who when they had examined me, wanted to let me go because there was no cause for putting me to death. But when the Jews spoke against it, I was compelled to appeal to Caesar, not that I had anything of which to accuse my nation. For this reason, therefore, I have called for you to see you and speak with you, because for the hope of Israel I am bound with this chain. Paul takes a few days to settle in, and then he calls for the leaders of the Jews. Now, don't misunderstand here. This isn't the leaders of the Jews in Jerusalem. This isn't the Sanhedrin. This is the leaders of the Jews in the area of Rome, that he calls them together. Now, Paul hasn't been to Rome yet. Paul wanted to come to Rome. He had written to the Romans about this before. But, you know, for whatever reason, he had been hindered, not able to come to Rome. Paul's finally at Rome. As Paul did in every place that he went to, the first thing that he does is meet with the Jews. And so here, that's what he does. Meets with the Jews. Now here, he is a prisoner. So he's not able to go to the synagogue as he did when he was doing on his missionary journeys. But instead here, he calls for the Jews to come to his house, his rented house, so he can meet with them and speak with them. He gives a defense for himself, but really that's not his primary purpose. His primary purpose is simply to minister to them, as he had done everywhere else. The Jews of the homeland in Jerusalem, as well as the Jews that were scattered, and all the synagogues of all the cities that he went to in his missionary journeys. He was presenting Jesus Christ as their Messiah, and this will now be his last stop on that journey. Presenting Jesus Christ to the Jews as their Messiah. This will be it. They've rejected Paul everywhere else, but now here at Rome, he's going to do this one more time. In fact, it's why he is at Rome. To deliver the message to the Jews in Rome that Jesus Christ is their Messiah. He started out by saying, men and brethren. He had called them together in the middle of verse 17, and he said, men and brethren. Now, when we use that term, we often think of fellow believers. But that's not the way Paul is using it here. They're brethren in the sense that they are fellow Jews. They're fellow Jewish men. And so that's why he uses the term brethren for them. And he answers the charges against him. What are the charges against him? He hasn't forsaken the Jews or the customs, that is the law of Moses. He hasn't broken any Roman laws, or he would have been set free. But the Jews forbid it. So he was forced to appeal to Caesar. And he is guilty of what? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So I wanted to meet with you face to face, he says, and talk about these things. And that's where we'll pick up next time.